The Stage Left podcast tells the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success and gleans what we can about the working practices of the greats from those who were in close proximity when the magic was being made. The podcast also aims to extract key advice to help a future generation of musicians in an increasingly complex industry. For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked closely with the likes of David Bowie, Elvis, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan and many more, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, like us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter at The Stage Left Pod. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes. There's many of you out there, so hi to everybody. And write reviews. That really helps us if you could write a review if you like the episode. Okay, enjoy the episode. This is Pete Lockett. Welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we chat to a man who has been voted no less than three times as the number one world percussionist by readers of Drum Magazine. A man who has reached every corner of the globe with his critically acclaimed mastery of diverse percussive styles, and a man who's collaborated with a staggering list of artists including Bjork, Peter Gabriel, Robert Plant, The Verve, Aphex Twin, Evelyn Glennie, Pet Shop Boys, Noel Gallagher and Amy Winehouse. On top of this, Pete has released 15 wonderful solo albums and also recorded ethnic percussion on five James Bond films, thanks to his close working relationship with David Arnold. Today we'll be finding out what it's like to play David Letterman, what musicians can learn from embracing music of non-Western origin, and if the rumour is true, Pete once managed to blow up the Pro Tools system at the legendary Ayr Studios. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is the legendary multi-percussionist and multi-award winning Pete Lockett. Thanks for joining us today, Pete. How's it going?
Good to meet you, Chris. Yeah, good to be here.
Good stuff. Now, I believe you've just been away. I just saw on your Twitter earlier today, you just got back from Dubai, is that right? Was
yeah,
that recording?
Dubai, or? I've had Dubai and India this year. Dubai was with a guy called Rahul Sharma, who's a famous Santur player from India, and a mix of musicians from all over the world, Arabic musicians, and a whole interesting range of unlikely an unlikely combination. So it's good to be involved in that type of thing.
And was that recording something new or was that a
live
performance?
No, that was live. That was a live gig.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. And how do you find the prospect of travelling these days? Because as many of our listeners will know, that Pete has travelled so much, literally to every corner of the globe, it seems, on a very frequent basis. Has the novelty worn off yet?
No, I love travelling. You know, you're always going to different places, you're meeting new people. You always got different challenges and different things that cross your path. So yeah, I love it. I mean, the only downside to a point is security at airports. That's just a little bit it's a little bit annoying. But I'm completely planned. I've even got like a belt that's got a plastic buckle, so I can go
through
really
there.
Quickly. Even though someone in front of me that's taken about 40 minutes to take everything out of their pocket, and
So I trust take a lot of the equipment with you or on airplanes and that kind of thing. Is it all there ready for you now when you go and record?
Yeah, most of the places. I mean, most, because I'm lucky to be with, Remo Percussion, Mapex Drums,
yeah,
Zildjian Cymbals and Vic Firth Drumsticks. So pretty much wherever I go in the world, plug.
Yeah, that's the one.
They have stuff, there for me. So
yeah,
even in India, like Mapex and Remo have got distribution in India. And so, I'm going to India again in March. And, I just sent the email this afternoon to the people, I need this and that,
Great.
That'll all be there.
So, good stuff.
Sorry to interrupt. Some of the smaller stuff, more unusual stuff like the tabla or, bespoke items, I still have to have a couple of 23-kilo bags, but not, my maximum was 15 grand going to Hong Kong.
Really?
Excess luggage, yeah.
Oh, my word.
But those days are gone. I was just into music. I started late and
19, is that right?
19, yeah.
It's so, unusually late, isn't it, for
a
musician?
I was walking past a drum shop, saw an advert in the window, and 2 weeks later, I was in a punk band. So
really,
that was good.
and it was a gig at the Alexandra Palace, I think. Was it the India Festival that you went to?
Festival of India, yeah.
Festival of India, right? Okay,
yeah.
And that changed your musical course. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, my friend lived next to Alexander Palace, and there was a huge festival. I mean, that would have been in the 80s, 86, 87, I think. I'm not sure exactly when. But there was, like, they built life-size temples, and it was just huge, absolutely massive. I knew nothing about India. But it was like a month long. So, we'd go over there and have some gulab jams and you know, Indian sweets and hang out and stuff like that. But, you know, it was just like an interesting thing. Yeah. It was just a festival and it was interesting. But then one night we're sitting in his place and with the windows open, and this music started to come through the window and we're like, oh, what's that? So we went off with like the Bisto Kids. It was like music that I'd never heard before, you know. Yeah. It's just like completely...
You described it as mysterious.
Well, obviously, if you've not heard Indian music before ever, you know, it's... And, you know, you've been listening to punk and rock and pop and stuff like that, then it's just sounds completely like, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a completely different kind of... Everything about it is intrinsically, you know, kind of different. Of course, it's coming from the same human root, the desire to make music and the musical expression, but, you know, it's just put out in a very different way. It's, you know, one of the things that characterises, I think, Indian music and a lot of music that you find, you know, around in other parts of the world is the transparency. So if you just have, like, two instruments, like a stringed instrument and a percussive instrument, it's incredibly transparent. But when you've got, like, a band, and I'm not saying one's better than the other, or, you know, I'm just saying they're different.
Yeah.
You've got a band, keyboards, drums, bass, guitar... You know, it's not transparent. You know, it's deeply arranged in the way that an orchestra would be deeply arranged.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's that... And in the beginning, I found that transparency hard to deal with because I thought there should be more going on.
Did you feel exposed as a player?
No, I'm not so much talking about playing it at that point, because at that point I was a listener and I was, you know... I mean, I'm still a student now, but, as a listener in the beginning, I found it difficult to... I found it very inspiring, but difficult to listen to in the sense that it was so different to all of the density. The density of the music is different.
Gotcha. And why did you then pursue that mystery? You know, I love the fact that you found that mysterious. Why did you park the punk stuff to a certain...
Well, I didn't really park it for a while. In fact, you know, I was fixated by it. It was kind of mysterious and interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we can't choose the things that interest us, you know, much as people think they can. You can't. If it grabs you and you're totally taken by it, you know, you can't do anything about that, you know.
And you had some lessons, is that right, by a student of Ali Akbar Khan? Tabla lessons?
Yeah, Yusuf Ali Khan, yeah.
Right, tell us about those.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was the thing. I mean, that, you know, to go back to the you know, starting out with the Indian music, I saw the concert and it was like, wow, that's amazing. And then a few weeks later, there was a free newspaper came through. I lived in Tottenham then. Mm-hmm. Free newspaper came through the front door, opened up on the mat, and there was a big advert for tabla lessons. And I was like, wow, that's weird. So I went along and had tabla lessons.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of interesting. And I find it, you know, it's fascinating because the way you play the drums and everything about it is completely different, completely unique. And, you know, the fact you've got the vocalization of the syllables of, you know, of the sounds of the drums and stuff like that. And then I really got into it, but then it was only ever to accompany my drum set playing. I was only looking for ideas.
Right.
You know, much as I was interested, it was a side study.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you get more and more into it, you become completely... you know, I became completely obsessed with it. You know, I mean, I was having four-hour lessons a week, and, you know, that's all I did. I didn't work. I didn't do anything. I just did that. Wow. Ate very simply, and you know, university of life and all that. You know,
what specifically were you picking up from that style that you were bringing to? Because if you were still playing in punk bands and that kind of thing, and you were looking,
for it, well, that was the thing. I couldn't really in the beginning, and it took me years and years to develop how to integrate the two styles. So, you know, what I kind of ended up doing was just focusing on the Indian thing for years. For like 6 years I did that, the four-hour lessons and everything. And then still, you know, like 1% you learn of it. It's just such a deep and intense kind of musical genre. So would really focus on that and then see how can I bring it into the drum set playing. But then I couldn't really work out because it's so different. And only years later, like 10 or more years later, did it kind of click through my education work, through educating and teaching stuff. And that's when I wrote my book, Indian Rhythms for the Drum Set book, which is on Hudson Music.
Yep.
So it's one of those things, it has to happen organically and naturally. Mm-hmm. So I've tried to force it in the beginning, but all the doors were closed. So, and in that process, I just got completely absorbed in learning that music.
About Indian music, that it's an ocean of rhythmic knowledge developed over centuries. And what are the standout aspects of Indian music that you think Western drummers could learn from?
Oh, there's just so much. I mean, it's the way, you know, because it's been developed in such a way. First of all, the whole mathematical calculations and the way that they subdivide time and develop the timeline. And split the timeline up, and then from that, you know, kind of gathering of smaller units, then you're building a vocabulary that you can build so much other stuff from. And then beyond that, the systems that they've developed of rhythmic modulation and the way they play with the timeline, so you get a lot of rhythmic illusions and moving around with the time, but having a specific timeline, because, you know, pretty much all classical Indian music is in one... you know, if you get one piece of classical Indian music, it's in one time signature, it's in 7 or 11 or 9 or whatever, and it will stay in that. And all the calculations and mathematics happen. Basically, it's about, you know, serving that timeline and showing at any point in the performance where you are in that timeline. And then beyond that, the idea of how they build solos and how they, you know, develop ideas, a lot of theme and variation development, and a lot of taking a theme and seeing what, you know, what can be built from that theme. You know, the rhythmic development is continually part of the timeline, whereas I think, you know, with a lot of Western music, not so much jazz, bebop kind of approach, but you know, funk or rock, or it's kind of a static timeline in a sense. I mean, not in a negative way. I mean, I love all the, you know, genres of, of things, you know, but it's kind of a static timeline, and which is kind of penetrated with different events. Rather than the timeline being developed. And it's a kind of, you know, you listen to the two things and you could compare them and you know, come up with an analytical, you know, observation of it. But so another kind of a simple way of putting it, so if, you know, so you're going to get a drummer that's going to, you know, do a drum fill every 8 bars or 16 bars, or going to the downbeat, and you know, so it's, which is great, you know, in within the musical genre, all the musical genres have their own equally valid, you know, position.
And one question off the back of that is, why do you think so many Western musicians find it such a challenge when presented with non-4-4 time signatures, particularly at first, you know, obviously you develop, and but at the beginning, why is that such a challenge to us?
Well, I think it's familiarity as much as anything. I mean, they're not so used to it. I mean, I wasn't really used to it in the beginning. But, of course, in daily life, you know, even the words that we're speaking now, or, you know, the rhythm of the washing machine, or the, you know, my food alarm is in 7. You know, so when the roast beef is cooked, you know, the alarm goes off and it's in 7. But, you know, people wouldn't necessarily hear it, but they're things in everyday life. And, you know, the way that we speak is not in 4-4 at all. So it's actually very natural, you know, to have unusual time lengths. But it's just familiarity about, know, is it put into a musical structure? You know, if you go to, I mean, one of the things, like, if you take, for example, Balkan music, where they've got a lot of kind of 7s and 5s, but it's kind of, I was kind of say it's like in the rails, like they create this, and then they're all stuck in playing that groove. Whereas in India, they might have the same groove, but they'll start to do, you know, 9+5, 9, 9, 5, 5, you know, equaling 14. So they'll kind of just begin to dissect it in a different way, so it takes it out of the grooves,
right I'm
with you, know, and so you've got a different thing. But you know, for me, I don't think it's just a matter of familiarity, you know,
familiarity
with a little bit of time. Doesn't matter whether you're from India or you know, London or wherever, you know, he's got the equal ability to learn different time signatures and different rhythmic feels.
Are there any bad habits that people can pick up at the early stages of approaching new time signatures for the first time? Or what advice or guidance would you give to someone who's kind of just going into that for the first time? Any correct things? Is it counting? Literally counting? Do you think that's the best way? Or?
Well, every you know, I mean, to be honest, you could say 4-4. You know, if you want to start playing around with 4-4 and you know, doing different stuff, then you know, you're kind of posed with similar problems. You know, if you want to divide it 9995, for example, mm-hmm. equaling 32, then you know, you kind of got the same problem that you would have in 7
if it
was 9595.
Right.
And so the fact that the Indians work with these little rhythmic units that they're always sticking together means that it's easy for them to work in different time signatures because that's what they do in 4-4 anyway.
Right.
So even in 4-4, they're not always in 4-4. They're always, you know, doing something,
a
little bit out there with it, which makes it really interesting, you know.
Mm. So let's talk about some of your solo stuff. A particular album that I enjoyed listening to, Taiko Tatabla, that was with Joji
Hirota.
Absolutely love that. Tell us about that kind of hybrid of two styles, because Japanese guy, is that right?
Japanese, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, that was one of my first collaborations. In fact, it was my first collaboration ever.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up doing solo stuff, because before that point, I was just doing sessions and stuff like that. And then I did a gig in Italy, and the promoter was from Portsmouth. I was from Portsmouth originally, and I lived in London at the time, though. And I got back from Italy, and a couple of days later he called me, and he said, oh, he's putting together this last minute percussion festival at the Festival Hall in London, because the dates had fallen through, some other project had fallen out, and they said, oh, put a percussion festival. So he said, do you want to do a solo show?
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, whatever, put the phone down, and you know, and that's when I thought, actually, what can I do? And then I you know, phoned up Joji, and we put that project together, and which is great, you know. Then
it
sold out, and we did that a couple of years in a row, toured, did a lot of touring, and then Bill Bruford came to one of the gigs, and then that's how my second project happened, the project with Bill and the quintet, percussion quintet.
And another album that you had, I think, in 2007, that you played on, which is the Parallax Beat Brothers, is that right?
Yeah, that was an interesting one.
Yeah, because it was electronic, a lot of it. What challenges did that throw up when you first kind of started?
Yeah, it's a different one. That's the thing. I mean, actually, it's a bit like, you know, when you're a session musician, you kind of got to be open to, you know, you go there and you do what they want. You know, if they want a shaker and a tambourine for 6 hours, then that's kind of what you do. So part of the thing of being a session musician is training yourself to, you know, be sensitive to what people want in scenarios, and then adjusting yourself to fit. You know, they're hiring you. You know, you're not.
Yeah.
They're not hiring you to go along and tell them, oh, look, you know, that you should have a bongo solo on this, on this romantic ballad.
Well, because that's interesting. Because I was going to come to this in a bit, but as we're there now, I want you to describe the relationship that you think, or the relationship between what the music needs and what the artist wants from you. Have there been times in the past where you're crying out to play on a particular track in a particular way, and you've just had to toe the line as such?
Well, you often try different things with tracks, but you know, going back to the Scanner thing, the Parallax Beat Brothers, you know, that was a really interesting project to do, because I mean, all of my other collaborations had been, you know, with kind of musicians, if you like. So you've got like a common ground of where you can go and how you can build the project. You know, all of my collaborations in India are like that. They're kind of with musicians, and you build it in a certain way. I mean, not a cliched way, but there are certain things that are going to lead you. Whereas the thing with Scanner was really interesting, because he's a sound designer, you know.
Right.
And you know, for me, that was really interesting, because it made me had to completely rethink everything that I did.
Really?
And so, yeah, so it was a really interesting, particularly live. In the studio, it's not so much, because, you know, I'm kind of used to doing that in the studio environment anyway. I, you know, do whatever it takes for a track to work, you know.
Yeah.
But to actually do that with him, and, you know,
what,
and
specifically,
that's why
was it difficult that was live? What specifically was it?
Well, it's just you've got to adjust to, you know, working in different ways. You can't rely on your, you know, you can't suddenly whip out your virtuosity in the, in the middle of like a groovy thing that's going on, you know. That's not the point of it.
Yeah.
You know, the point of it is the bigger picture of the piece. That's why I love, you know, people like Brian Eno and David Byrne and stuff like that, you know, musicians who have not necessarily, they're not musicians, and they'd be the first person to tell you that they're not, you know, virtuosic musicians at all, but they're great visionaries.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's, I would take someone who's a visionary over someone who's a virtuoso player every day of the week, you know, every day of the week.
Then you focused on India with your next two albums. I think it was Journeys with the Master Percussionists of India and Made in Kolkata. Both beautiful albums. I listened to them over the last few days. You must have been pleased how they turned out.
Yeah, great. You know, I mean, it's hard work, you know, putting those projects together, bringing all the different elements together. And kind of, you know, one of the things about it is it's not Indian music as such. It's using Indian influences and using Indian musicians, but it's kind of creating a, you know, that's why I like the word parallax, because it's kind of creating it from a different, you know, a different view.
Yeah.
A different, like, this is what I've learned, and I, you know what, I'm not Indian.
Yeah, yeah.
In case you didn't notice, I'm not Indian. Everyone.
Yeah.
but this is what I've made of, you know, the Indian music that I love, you know, and the Indian people that I love. You know, my wife's half Indian.
Yeah, right.
You know, so, like, this is what I've made of it. This is my view of it, you know. And for me, I've found that the actual, you know, I've been lucky to work with some of the real absolute, you know, masters of Indian Indian music all through generations, you know. And, you know, they're much more interested in someone who's kind of... as you know, as a performer and a collaborator, you know, as someone who's going to learn, you know, learn to do their stuff, but with a different angle and in a different way, rather than, oh, I'm going there and I'm going to pretend to be Indian. And
so it's,
I mean,
not a precious thing.
First of all, if you do, you go to India and you, you know, you try and, you know, play tabla like an Indian, or I mean, the standard is so ridiculously high. I mean, it's just completely and utterly, you know, really something else.
This is the day and the hour, the time when the change begins. The land and the sky are twined.
Obviously, that kind of hybrid of using different styles and influences has made you a very unique musician in the West, and you've obviously had a lot of great collaborations over the years. Tell us about working with big personalities. If you're a young musician working big personalities for the first time, I know you've worked with the likes of Peter Gabriel, Robert Plant. What advice would you give to them, you know, working in that environment for the first time?
Just think about the music. That's all. You know, forget who you're working with. Just got to play the music. I mean, they're to play the music, you know. It was... that was, there was a guy, who was the guy out of Breaking Bad, I forget his name.
Anyway,
well,
the guy who played Walter White was Bryan Cranston.
Right, Bryan Cranston. Well, there was a thing I saw on an interview with him, and it, you know, he said that he used to go to auditions and would try and please them and try and, you know.
Yeah.
And then he realised, actually, that's not what his role is. Like, philosophically... you just got to go there and act. He's an actor. You go there and act. You walked out the door and you forget it. It either went well or it didn't. They either call you or they don't.
Yeah.
You know. So you go into a session. You don't try and please them. You don't try and look cool or get them to be your buddy in, you know, overnight. You know, just play the music.
Just
play the music as well as you can. If it's good enough, great. You know, if it's not, don't beat yourself up about it. Move on, and maybe next time it will be.
Let's take a Bjork song. I think you did Isabel. And what was your remit for that? Because obviously that was a remix and that was kind of brought to you. Were you given free rein there?
Well, not really. They wanted, you know, congas, and they you know, want, some people want a specific thing. You know, in that instance, they wanted a specific thing, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
But she was good to work with. I mean, she was, you know, she'd come and sing the parts that she wanted. And,
oh, really?
And, you know, yeah, great. Very, very, you know, some, you know, I mean, some... people aren't even there in the studio, or you go and record an album with someone who never even meet them, you know.
Yeah. And that was about 97, was that right?
No idea. Right. Definitely younger.
He's definitely younger. Okay. Yeah, Bjork, absolute legend. And tell us about working with Peter Gabriel, because I know you did the David Letterman show. I watched it earlier, actually. It's still online. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. I saw it earlier. I saw it with you. Yeah. Tell us. us about working Peter Gabriel, and perhaps also about advice you give young musicians when playing high profile gigs.
Yeah, well, that was with Africout Sound System.
That's right.
With Africout Sound System with Peter Gabriel, and that was yeah, great. I mean, the thing is, you know, when you meet these people, they're just normal people. It's like easy if you're not used to meeting, you know, kind of famous people or people who are off high profile. There's a tendency to think, you know, that it's, well, just making the situation bigger than it is.
Yeah.
It's just like us meeting,
what,
you know.
In regards to actually the working practices of Peter Gabriel and how, you know, what would a musician learn specifically from someone like Peter Gabriel that they wouldn't learn from someone else?
Well, I mean, it's different on in each different aspect, and it depends on what your working relationship is with that person, you know. So, for example, when I was working with Phil Manzanera, you know, he was one of those people, you know, one of those visionary people, actually, that was like, oh, let's, at one point we had all the, took all the studio apart and had the bins in and all that sort of stuff.
Really?
It was really, really interesting. So, you know, you learn from that. What you learn from everyone with their vision. You know, everyone's got something that you're going to learn.
Yeah.
You know, how they hear something, you know.
And you tweeted recently, talking about working big personalities, Noel Gallagher, you're recording with him at the moment. What's that been like?
Yeah, great. Again, it's just a geezer, you know. That's it, you know.
Just a geezer, okay.
No, but that's it. That, you know, you talk about football and you know.
And what kind of stuff are you doing there? Is it your traditional kind of...
No, that was all just like top-end stuff, bits and bobs, some drums.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you playing actually drums? Bongos.
Not drum set, no,
oh,
percussion.
Right, okay. Percussion, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you doing a lot of stuff on that album or just...
Yeah, reasonable amount, yeah.
Cool. And
ongoing.
Still ongoing. All right, okay. And you played with Shlomo, is that right, at Glastonbury?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, he's a beatboxer. Tell us about that experience. That must have been something new, was it, when you first worked with him?
Not really, because, you know, I've worked with so many different types of musicians, so I'm not really fazed by anything, because, again, you kind of, like, whether you're in the studio working with someone famous or you're working with a new project, you're kind of looking at, you know, you're both, everyone's looking at where do you find the music.
You're
trying to get to where the music is, that's the thing. And that's why you're not really thinking about who you're working with or it's a posh studio that the Beatles recorded in. Or, you know, it's nothing of that's relevant.
Yeah.
All that's relevant is the music. You know, and then it's not an achievement thing. Is do you make something that fits in nicely with the track or the or the, you know, film or whatever.
Talking of which, David Arnold said of you, "I've used Pete on many of my Hollywood film scores, and I'm always impressed with his range of sounds and grooves he creates. His ability to make ethnic drums sit comfortably in any setting makes the process so much easier." You worked on 5 Bond films, is that right?
Yeah.
And tell us about working with David Arnold. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, I've worked with him, you know, closely for ages. Really, the first thing I think was the Shaken Not Stirred album,
right?
Or Shaken and Stirred, I don't know what it is, whatever.
By whom, sorry? Was that his own?
No, that was the Bond...
Oh, right. Of course, right. Yeah, Shaken, Not Stirred. Yeah, I get it.
And it was all the theme tunes, I think, or something. I can't remember. Natasha Atlas was on it and loads of different singers singing different tracks. So that was the first thing. And then, just started to do all his films and pretty much everything he did for a while. Then we had a duo together at one point. We did the Purcell Room as a duo.
Oh, right, okay.
He turned up with a desk bigger than the actual stage. I hired this like 60-channel desk or something for on stage. It's like,
really,
honestly.
And tell us what happened at Air Studios when you were recording something for Bond. Is it true that you blew up the system?
Yeah, the first one to.
How'd that happen?
Blow up just because there was so much. There was so many. I mean, I had the whole hall and the side rooms all full of drums. So it was like I had a week there.
Right.
But it was all done with surround sound, so there was so many mics, so everything had, you know, and this couldn't deal with it. It got to a certain point, and
did you get the blame?
150 channels or something, you know, and then it just stopped. I mean, it didn't blow up in the sense that flames came out. It just crashed, you know.
Did you get the blame? Did they mind?
Not me. No. I didn't put all the bloody mics there.
that's fair enough. Okay, great. And... red light syndrome, you don't strike me as a person who would ever suffer from that, but you must have spoken in your education work with musicians who might suffer from that. Any tips or advice?
What is it?
Red light syndrome.
Yeah.
Well, when you're in the studio and the producer says, well, we're going live now, and you see that red light and you tighten up and you're just not quite as loose as you want to be.
Right.
And working under pressure once that kind of recording's going. Any advice for that?
Just think about the music. You know, I think if you always come back and think about the music, and that's your starting point, because that's what you're there to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're not there to, you know, for them to light your jacket or, you know, think you've got a brilliant haircut or... That's not what you're there for. You're there to just make music. And as long as you can just, like, relax and...
Well, but what is the key to that, relax?
Well, I think it's a, you know, it's a complex question to answer simply. You know, I think that you've got to be comfortable with yourself. You've got to be... you know, for me, I think 60% of being a rounded, mature and kind of wise musician is philosophy. You know, I'm always thinking about the philosophy of, you know, why I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, where I'm doing it, when I do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's you've got to... and then you think, I'm going in the studio, you know, what am I trying to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And if you boiled that question down to just the bare bones, you know, it would be, you know, the objective is to be able to play something that they like, you know.
Yeah.
And so to relax and, you know, go back to your love of music, go back to how you felt when you first sat at your instrument or first sat at the drum set,
mm-hmm.
how much you enjoyed it and how much you, the child, how much it wanted to
do
it. And then also you've got to free yourself up, you know. It's like if you, you know, if you can do it and it's good enough, then great. You know, if it goes radically off the rails, you know, then you know, come out of it knowing you did as well as you could, and then move on and build up strength to, you know, the next opportunity. But it's not, there's not a simple answer.
It's a psychological thing, is it? Yeah. So it's not a particularly straightforward answer.
Really, actually, the answer's not about music at all. It's like, how do you feel about yourself when you sit on the tube with someone opposite you?
Yeah.
You know, at every point in your life, you've got to be thinking about what you know, because in that situation, it's not what they think of you; it's what you think they think of you.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's what you think of you.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of weird, and then of course, equal thing. What do you think of them?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So everything's got the same validity.
Yeah. Cool. Tell us about the Drum Jam app.
Yeah, it's with a guy called Jesse Chapel and Sonosaurus in Washington. We got a partnership. Originally, I wanted an app that was like, I don't know if you know, I can't remember what it's called, an Urban Spoon.
Right.
It was like a little fruit machine, and you shook your iPhone and three different restaurants near you would come up.
Oh, right.
And I thought, actually, it'd be good to if there was that, but if it was like rhythms. So you could have like a shaker and a cowbell, and you shake it up something different, and then, you know, shake it in a different way, and they keep the instruments the same, but the grooves change.
Right.
So that was the initial idea, and then I started approaching people, and they all wanted like 30 or 40 grand to develop it, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I got in touch with Jesse, who was actually the person that I wanted to work with the most. He had an app called Thumb Jam.
Right, okay, right.
And it transpired he was a drummer.
Ah.
And he was really into the idea.
Yeah.
And so we just got like a 50-50 partnership and developed it. And it's doing really well, you know.
And who can benefit from it?
Well, everyone, really. I mean, first of all...
Just drummers?
No, absolutely.
No, that's
in fact, that's the smallest audience we've got is drummers.
Right, okay.
Amazingly. But yeah, I mean, it's first of all, it's all acoustic percussion, so it's, you know, all recorded. It's not MIDI.
Yeah.
And there's loads and loads of each instrument has lots of variations within the pattern. It goes from like 60 BPM to 200.
Mm.
I mean, literally millions of variations, millions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just with what we had in the opening pack was more than 3 million variations, but now we've got three times the amount of content. So I don't know what the maths of that is.
Yeah.
But you know, definitely a lot of millions of combinations. There's all that. There's you know, solo pads that you can play just by dragging your finger and so it's good for you know, professional music making, in the sense that you can export everything, you can record your performances, export it to your DAW, or you can upload it to SoundCloud or email it or whatever as WAV files, 16-bit WAV files. And then also educationally, you know, you can put lots of parts together. It's better than a metronome.
Mm-hmm.
It's great for, you know, some people, you know, people that have been ill in hospital and stuff and, you know, can't move much. And
yeah.
I get a lot of emails from people saying, oh, this made bloody blah really happy. It was,
oh, right.
Or she was nice. Like, just playing with it there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an enormous number of benefits. It's very educational. There's loads of information about all the instruments in the app. And,
right. And we can get that at your website, yeah? Would that be your website?
No, it's just Apple. You just, know, just,
oh, right, okay. Yeah,
it's,
oh, right,
and
okay.
It's on Android now. It's on,
it's on Android as well.
On,
okay.
Yeah, Galaxy. It's in the Galaxy store.
Cool.
And Apple Apple store. Drum Jam. Or just put Pete Lockett in the App Store and Drum Jam will come up.
Nice one. We'll begin to wrap up, Pete. One thing I wanted to ask you is, what fears do you have for the music industry, if any? And if so, how might they be addressed?
Yeah, well, I think it's the same with kind of all art, really. I mean, part of the problem that we got, and I kind of got this from some of my kind of ethnic collaborations, where you'd go, like in Rajasthan, I would go deep into the desert for 6 hours and spend, you know, a few days going around villages and mm-hmm. putting together projects. And you realise that in there, you know, like music's integrally part of their life. It's part of their everyday life. It's not like they're doing it to be famous or rich or to be like a virtuoso musician.
Yeah.
It's just part of their daily life. And I think we've kind of forgotten that a little bit in the West. Now it's become commodity and fashion.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and something you can own or something you can achieve at.
Yeah.
And it's wrong. It's not like that. That's not what the core of music is. And that's what you've kind of got to, like the guy in the studio or girl in the studio who's going to go and be nervous when the red light is on. That's what you've got to remember, that core, that a priori, you know, sense of music that we all have deep within us. So the danger of anything, whether it's music or, you know, any aspects of art or, you know, things that, you know, kind of really mean something to our, you know, personal being as humans, is that it's become commercialized and devalued because of it. And so as soon as you've got that, you've lost the you've lost its inner sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's become something that's a shell of what it should be.
Yeah.
Because it's lost its setting. So, you know, there in the village, and I'm not idealizing one or the other, you know, they've both got benefits.
Yeah.
You know, the freedom of being, you know, in the West and being in this environment is, you know, great. But you know, there they've got community. As a consequence of community, they've got art. You know, but here we don't actually have community.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, next door neighbour's been there for like 4 years and I've spoken to him twice. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like that, actually, to be honest. I really like that. But there's no community. And so because there's no community, there can't really be any shared art. Mm-hmm. There can only be commodity and things that we go and look at. I just find it really obscure to go into the Tate or and stare at something on a wall with a load of people with headphones on being told, this is what this is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like someone's sock hanging from a nail and a like a blue, green, orange rubber nose.
Yeah.
And they're being told art speak, oh, this means this and that. And it's like, it's a freaking sock and a rubber nose, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you like it or you don't. It's like a tree. You don't see people walking around Hampstead Heath with headphones on, you know, saying, being told what the tree is. Oh, this is a tree, you know, there's the leaves are green and you know, it's been here for ages.
Yeah.
And you know, in the winter the leaves fall off.
Yeah.
You know, oh great, look, what are we gonna go and look at now? Oh, this is a bush. It's like, for me, I just find it abstract and obscure, you know. I see, you know, I just enjoy looking at natural, you know, things, even, you know, stuff in the street and obscure graffiti and you know, for me that's as valid as any exhibit
and you think obviously that's been lost in the music industry, that artistic kind of integrity or perhaps the artistic
I don't think it's been lost. I think the problem is that you've got all the musicians that are fighting because that's where they come from, but they're all, you know, not all, but you know, on a quite a large scale, a lot of people are confused as to about actually what is my medium, what is it I'm doing here, you know, why am I playing music, like, oh, I've got an album out, you know, or I've achieved something, you know, and basically you start to you know, confuse the end result with the inspiration.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah, I can see that.
So, and I think Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, he has two terms that I really like. I don't know, you may have seen this in some interviews, so I always say it, but it's praxis and poesis. And they're two terms that he used, not in terms of music, but in terms of like philosophical doctrine, of poesis as an action that contains a goal outside of itself, whereas praxis contains its own goal. So if you play music simply to play music,
yeah,
then you're in good faith with yourself. But if you play music because you want to get laid or you want to get rich or famous, yeah, then it's a goal outside of itself. It's not the music.
Yeah,
it's an abstract goal. Mm. So it's two steps away from the thing itself. And so, of course, it's more complicated than that because you've got to earn a living, you know, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, I kind of like to keep those two words at the core of my being. And like, see, you know, we waver. It's like a gravitational force between the two, you know. But try and stay on the philosophical path if you can. And
that's a great insight. Love it. Absolutely love it. And obviously very philosophical. I know you've done a lot of writing in the past. I think you even wrote a sci-fi novel.
Exactly,
is that right?
Yeah, it came out
Survivor's
last year,
Guide
yeah.
to Eternity?
Exactly.
Yeah, tell us about that. That's a bit left field from everything else that you've
yeah,
done.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote a novel when I first came to London.
Oh, right.
But it wasn't very good. The storyline was good. It was these two people travelling through time in the opposite direction. And they had to meet in the middle, otherwise they wouldn't exist.
Cool.
So that was the premise of it. Good story, but it wasn't I couldn't write at the time. But then, you know, a couple of years ago, I was so much time in airports and I started to write. I just woke up with the idea.
Yeah.
And then, like I said at the beginning of this, you know, podcast, was that, you know, when something grabs you, you can't deny it. You can't stop it.
Mm.
And so I started to write and I couldn't stop. So I actually wrote the book in 3 months. You know?
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Like, I think it's 90,000 words. But then, you know, it takes you 18 months to edit and stuff like that. But the actual core of the story.
And do you think that's something you'll continue to do? Do you think writing is in that way?
You know what,
medium?
I can't make a decision on it because it will decide for me.
Yeah.
If it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
You know,
that's good.
If it doesn't, you know, I'm not going to force myself to do it just because I've written one. I think, oh, well, I've got to write another one.
Just whatever comes to you.
Yeah.
Where the inspiration comes from.
Yeah.
Great stuff. Okay, we'll begin to wrap up. Career standout moments. I know you don't seem like the person who kind of sits there thinking about all the stuff they've done, but is there anything particularly you're proud of? Any output?
Well, you know, I'm kind of proud of it all, really. I mean, it's from humble beginnings. You know, I've done, you know, moved to London without any money whatsoever. I didn't know anyone. Lived in a little squalor bedsit basement that had been a concrete store for a few years before. You get out of bed and there'd be dust everywhere. And so... you know, I kind of fought hard to kind of achieve what I've achieved. Not so much, I don't really look at, you know, specific moments and say, you know, this or that. But, you know, there's certain things you're proud of. You know, becoming a professor in Shanghai.
Yeah, I heard that.
You know,
amazing.
Conservatoire. Or last year I got the Pandit Jazz Raj Award in India.
Wow.
Pandit Jazz Raj is like the Miles Davis of...
really?
You know, of North Indian classical music.
Wow.
And so, you know, certain things you're proud of, obviously some of the awards and stuff like that. But, I mean, awards, they don't really...
Yeah.
There's not a best.
And
you know, it's not. I mean, I would never even think of saying I was the best at anything.
No.
You can't be.
No.
It's impossible, you know. You can do as well as you can, you know.
Yeah. Fascinating. So what's next? I think you've got a tour coming up very soon.
Yeah, I've got a UK solo tour in April.
Tell us about those shows, because I've got the dates here. It's in April, and it's Cardiff, Fareham, Leeds, Manchester, East London, Acton, Bournemouth, Edinburgh and Colchester.
Yeah.
Tell us about those shows.
Yeah, it's all solo stuff.
Great.
So that'll be good. Yeah, and I'm off to Cuba in a couple of weeks.
I've really?
Cuba Drum Fest. And then
amazing.
Back out to India again.
Fantastic.
And then, you know, yeah. Canada and loads of different stuff happening
all over the place. Well, I'll come to the one you're playing in East London, PMT East London. That's the first place. It's very near me where I bought my first guitar. So I'll come along to that show.
Yeah,
I'll come along
brilliant.
To that show in April. That'll be absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and point people to my website, PeteLockett.com.
PeteLockett.com. Yes, yeah, great website. I've been in there all week. Loads of information and all of Pete's work and back catalogues on there. So hope you enjoyed it. Really, really a great pleasure and privilege to have you on the Stage Left podcast, Pete. And thanks for appearing.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Nice one.
For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, The Prodigy, Oasis, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @TheStageLeftPod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheStageLeftPodcast. See you next time.